So, the next talk is Bringing the Hack Back into the Chaos by Daniel Maslovsky. Daniel likes giving talks and workshops. In his free time, he works on free and open source software, especially operating systems and distributions, bringing up an application firm with a focus on tooling, integration, and documentation. They created Fitka, the firmware editor. While more and more hackerspaces have been founded in recent years, there are many different topics that are being discussed at the same time. AI, 3D printing, Arduino, social and political questions, and lots more. Where are the hacks, though? Things are happening, and with this talk, we want to talk about them and call for exchange.
Hi, I am Daniel, and today I am going to talk about things we do in our hackerspace and what we want to give back to the community. So if you've seen or heard me talk before, you know that I'm working a lot with hardware. And today we want to talk a bit more about specific tools that we built and needed for, you know, working with hardware. Let's have a quick look at the agenda here. I'm just going to give a very brief introduction to, you know, get some more context. I'm going to talk a bit about hacking on gadgets, because that is something we've been doing quite a lot at ChaosPod, our hackerspace in Essen. And then I will later go a bit deeper into a specific topic, because coincidentally, we just got to look a bit further into some firmware security issues. And yeah, that will cover the last part here. So yeah, for the introduction. So first, let's get some motivation, because there are a bunch of things we can do in, you know, the hacker scene, like, you know, like in the movies, like Hollywood hackers, we could do fun stuff. But we actually wanted to do something constructive as well. And I've looked around a bit, and I've seen that there are also not just hackers interested in looking further at devices nowadays, but also certain governments. For example, the EU. There is now a new act. There is, you know, movements to get rid of electronics as waste, because, you know, a bunch of electronics now exist all over the world, and we would like to cut down that waste. So one way of doing that, of course, is to reuse older devices, which is something we will also elaborate on in a bit. Now, another thing is the Cyber Resilience Act in the EU. You might have heard about it, or abbreviated, it's just CRA. That is a strategy by the EU to gain some more sovereignty again, because that is something, unfortunately, we lost quite a lot actually over the last year. So if you think about it, for example, in the space of like operating systems and also application software, there is a bunch that we actually buy from other countries, right? Everybody knows Microsoft as a very prominent example. You know, essentially, there is a bit of like, I would say 90% now of the machines used by the German government institutions, for example, which are all running Microsoft Windows operating systems. And that need not be the case, actually. So yeah, let's see what that gets us. And also, of course, there is this call for more transparency. As a, yeah, not direct counterpart, but a similar thing in the US is the Electronics Resurgence Initiative. Also talking about sovereignty, you know, in that sense here, it's about fabbing own chips. So that is also something we're looking into in the EU, and especially in Germany, where, you know, we're thinking about building up new fabs. And in fact, there is now some funding projects going on, albeit a bit complicated, but the general idea is there. And of course, there is always this idea of, you know, we need to hack back into other countries when they attack us. So that is something you might have seen all over the news. Sometimes, you know, populist politicians like to talk about that, because, it, you know, it is something that you can use to motivate people. You know, like some people really, you know, get pushed by politicians, you know, talking that way, like, hey, we need to act, we need to do something, and so on, without even a specific plan or anything. So here is a blog article from Rapid7, a very well-known security company, you know, discussing the issue a bit. I highly recommend you to look into all those links. And as usual, I will upload those slides here later so that you can have a closer look into everything. So what are we doing at ChaosPod in Essen? So there is a bunch of people now, you know, who have met and wanted to, you know, try out some things, or were just curious about things. And so we got to talk a bit. Of course, that takes a bit of time, you know, to build up a certain community, to figure out what each other's interests are. And I would now like to point out a few things that we're actually doing to, you know, shout out into the cybers. So first up, we have something that we call Petit Feu. That is a weekly session that we have on Wednesdays in the evening. Well, not every week, actually, but, you know, most or some in some weeks we have these sessions where, you know, we give short presentations. Sometimes we do a bit of a hands-on thing or something. You know, it's usually something like 10 or maybe 15 minutes. But, you know, it may also exceed, but the general idea is, you know, that we just quickly cover some topic. Like, you know, it doesn't have to go too deep, doesn't have to be very broad, right? So it's really about very, very specific ideas. And sometimes that actually leads us to surprising new findings. Then we have the blog. So at chaospod.de/blog, it's all written in German, but, you know, Google Translate might help if you don't speak German. Otherwise, you can read natively anyway. This is essentially where we, you know, write up where we've been, like projects we've worked on and stuff like that. Yeah, there is actually a bunch of things going on, so I highly encourage you to have a look at that now. Oh, well, or later, actually. Then there is now a group of people who are interested in something that is called Capture the Flag, which you might also have heard about. It's essentially, you know, a bit of a gamification, if you will, of software security issues, or also hardware security issues sometimes even. So, yeah, if you've heard about things like, you know, binary exploitation, data exfiltration, you know, there is a bunch of things that you can do. Web applications are a very prominent example that, you know, people set up, you know, on purpose that are a bit more vulnerable than usual, you know, to point out certain issues that you need to be aware of. So, yeah. If you are interested in that sort of stuff, if you are around our space, so definitely come by, have a look, you know, look at that blog article on the website, and of course visit us if you like. And otherwise, you might also find a local group actually doing this. There is even large competitions going on both nationally but also internationally. You will definitely find something in your area, I think. And then finally, we have a podcast. Well, it's it has its own cadence in a way, let's say. But, you know, there is a bunch of things that we've already talked about. Also, all in German at this point. I'm sorry if you don't speak the language. But yeah, for German speakers, it's definitely very, very interesting. For example, we just had an episode recently where one of our guys, Enrico, talked about a set-top box that he hacked on. And we will also look at that in a bit. Now let's talk a bit about the gadget hacking that we're doing. So first up, we've been to other places before, right? There is a bunch of these congresses that we have, and, you know, like MRMCD, for example, is a smaller congress, not as large as the Chaos Communication Congress, but there is still a good few thousand people there, or maybe just 1,000, I'm not too sure. But yeah, we presented there, and we talked about things that we actually hack on ourselves. So yeah, we brought a few gadgets, you know, we played around with them and gave some live demos, for example. We made a proposal. So the idea was to create a tool for visualizing device trees. That is something that is commonly being used for firmware and also operating systems in order to enumerate devices in your hardware. And then we also gave a shout out. So we actually want more people to do this, or, well, we want to encourage people to, you know, look closer at their devices, especially, you know, when you have some, let's say, some special gadget or something, and you might have some idea like, okay, I should be able to do this and that with that thing, but I'm not too sure how. You know, let's see if we can get something going and exchange about it. Just share whatever you figure out. And, you know, that's also what we did. So what you see here is the main board. It's essentially like a single board computer, if you know the Raspberry Pi. It's just a slightly different form factor. And, well, originally it has a case, so this is now unboxed, if you will. So you see the bare board. And this is something that we presented. And I put some notes in the Linux Sunchi wiki. That is a wiki all around chips by the company called Allwinner. And, well, guess what happened? After I had this article in there for a while, somebody else found it and, you know, continued hacking on this stuff, and then actually wrote me an email. We started exchanging a bit. And now there is a bit more work in progress there. So the first thing we did on this device here was, you know, just to, you know, execute a bit of our own code, which is somewhat easy because for Allwinner chips, there are already very great tools from the community for doing that. But this person already figured out, you know, how to actually use a stock Linux kernel, like a mainline kernel, and then read out the NAND flash that you see here on this board. And then, we can also work with that a bit more. So yeah, what we had just done was essentially just write to the console and do a bit of networking. Now we have a big storage part. So coming back to the device tree visualization, we actually did that. So I started a new project at the platform system interface organization on GitHub. You might have heard me talk about this before. So that is a larger umbrella project, let's say, all around hardware, essentially hardware platforms and interfaces to operating systems. So yeah, the general idea here is to get some visual representation of what is usually just giant text files. So of course, this here is not yet very perfect, but at least we could quickly draft something that could render us the tree and also distribute all the nodes in the tree in a way such that they are well aligned, So the challenge really here is, if you can read this here, this is almost 1,000 nodes in this just one tree, this here being from a laptop manufactured by Apple. And there is so much stuff in there. It's really hard to work with if you have no idea of what's going on in there. And this might give you a very quick overview. Of course, it's a bit hard to navigate such a large tree. We might work on that and give some more help. But yeah, it's a very good start now. And people actually already played around with that. So yeah, feel free to. There is a deployment online here on GitHub. So you can go to platformsysteminterface.github.io/dtvis. That's the device tree visualizer. And you can load your own device tree blob into this and then have it visualized almost immediately. The code for parsing that data is written in Rust. So if you are a Rust developer or you wanted to look into Rust at some point, you're very welcome to also work on that a bit more. Because currently we do not actually have all the data in there. This is just a rough implementation here. And of course, we would like to extend that over time. So yeah, you're welcome to file your pull requests. Yeah, speaking of the platform system interface project, that is something I talked about last year at the Fireshong stage. And it's, as I said, a very large umbrella project, actually. So yeah, you will find it on GitHub at the Platform System Interface organization. And I started writing down something that I call PSI spec, like a specification. I would like to have a general idea of what hardware platforms are like, because there are like quite some difference actually between like all the different vendors and all the different chips and instruction sets and all of that stuff. But at the same time, there are some general ideas which always hold in a way, with minor implementation details which differ a bit, but in general, those are very, very similar. So yeah, I talked about this, as I said, and here you find the link to my website where I always upload all the slides. And well, you're welcome to look at that again, or maybe do a recap of last year's talk. You can find it at media.ccc.de. Now let's talk about some actual devices that we just recently had in our hands. What you see here is something commonly called a TV box. If you search for a TV box on your favorite store, be it Amazon or eBay, or you just go to like an actual brick and mortar store, you will find boxes like this one. This year being something by a vendor called Transpeed, but you will find many, many different others because it's essentially a giant white label business there. So this year is based on a chip by the company Amlogic. It's if you know Allwinner and Amlogic, they're sort of in the same space. So Allwinner also makes these kind of chips for TV boxes, and then they have like in general very similar applications, also found on single board computers, for example. Yeah, so if you have one from Regra, for example, they use some Amlogic chips for some, I think, and also some others. You might have one already. And what we did here was, This is a box that you can just buy off the shelf, right? So usually it's like it's its own product in a way. The idea was never that you would really run your own software on it, but why not? So we did, and we successfully ran our own kernel that we built from the Android open source project. So if you look for AOSP or the Android open source project, you know, they have their own copy of the Linux kernel with their own like variants and extensions. So there are some things which will not land upstream at kernel.org, where you would usually find the Linux kernel. You know, sometimes because of like vendor specifics, you know, maybe they needed to push something out. Like in this case, for example, actually, you will find if you look at their kernel here, that is the ARM64 kernel that we ran on this machine because it's ARM based. There is actually a bunch of code in there, which is definitely not, made for pushing to kernel.org. It's essentially, there is a config, you know, which goes all around the code base and, you know. But it might actually be interesting to carve out some of that stuff and, you know, push that upstream so that we can also work with this box here. And if you would like to have a quick look at, you know, what it was like to bring this up, here is a link to the gist I put on GitHub. So yeah, but let's talk a bit more about the SoCs that MLogic makes or systems on chips. So the vendor is, as I said, you know, in a very competitive market, right? So the thing is, if you wanted to use some tools to work with their chips, you wouldn't actually really find much, except there is actually something. There is some vendor tools. They're not too great. You will find them on GitHub, usually in binary form. They're, you know, closed source. They're not disclosing how their chips work. So that is a bit of a problem for us if we want to work with those, because, you know, it's really hard to figure out how to use them. And there are some things which are really just, you know, not provided by those tools. Like, you know, what I would like to do, for example, is I would like to load some code into memory and then just run it, you know, to make a simple Blinky demo, for example, right? So I would like to attach some LEDs to my board and then, you know, have those LEDs blink. I don't want to, you know, write a whole operating system for it or, you know, already use an off-the-shelf system. I would like to have something very, very simple to work with. Well, fortunately, somebody already created a Python tool for that. It's, to be honest, it's a bit messy, but you will find it on github.com at supporter.quad9/pyamlboot. So it's, you know, written in Python. They have documented their findings in the protocol, so that is essentially the same thing that the vendor's tool would also do, but they have rewritten that in Python. They documented quite a lot of that stuff, not too perfectly, but it was a very, very good start for us. But there were still some features missing there, you know, which we wanted to extend. Now, the thing is, I don't really know much Python. I can read it a bit, but yeah, for me, it's a bit hard to work with. And also, you know, there were a bunch of files scattered around. Not to blame here, but yeah, it wasn't really, you know, what we could work with at that point. So what I suggested was, hey, I know Rust, right? So let's rewrite this tool in Rust and extend it. And so we did. It's now on my GitHub at orangecms/aml_boot. So that's what we call the tool. Now we actually found out that we can't really use the tool for the TV box I just showed you earlier, because that is one of the newer SoCs by MLogic. They made a different tool for it, so that is from the vendor again. It's called ADNL. Well, we also had a closer look at that one, and we quickly figured out that it's actually a fork of what is called Fastboot. If you've worked with Android devices, you might know the Fastboot tool, because it's something that, you know, talks to like a very early bootloader in the Android space. It's usually what you use also to flash your own custom ROMs, for example, or, you know, if you need to unlock the device, like there are unlock commands and stuff like that. Very OEM specific though. Well, and in ADNL, by, you know, taking a closer look, we actually even found some hidden commands. So usually they would just have something to flash to the device. So, you know, you could only write something to the storage, like to a NAND flash or something. But we wanted to, you know, just run some code or maybe look at the memory and so on. And that is actually what the commands could do that we figured out there. It's not yet written up fully in AML boot, but yeah, we will do that and, you know, then also be able to work with those devices. Now, the thing is, how do you really figure out the traffic that goes over USB, you know, how that really works and so on? So if you try to understand that from the binary, you would need to follow the code flow and see what payloads are being constructed and so on. That is a bit tedious. So what I figured out was, somebody actually told me at Chaos, but you can use Wireshark for that. So I had some ideas, and one idea was, we could just use fake USB devices also to test out the vendor tool and see what it would send, you know, without actually affecting a real device. Like there are some commands, for example, which we don't really want to run on the device. So we could use a fake USB device that, we could create through the Linux kernel. That is definitely a capability. Or we could also use some extra hardware. There are, for example, some very, very cheap and affordable USB microcontrollers that you can take today, you know, which would just let you set your own USB vendor ID and USB device ID or product ID. That is essentially how those devices are being identified. And then you would need to declare what capabilities you have. So you can literally just take that from the vendor if you connect the device and then, you know, rewrite that. Well, and then now you have a simulation target. Anyway, so up until now, as I said, we have this AML boot tool, and here's a short excerpt from its help text. So if you run this, we have used the library in Rust that is called clap, the command line argument parser, that allows you to very easily declare your command line tool. So you can, you can say there is a bunch of commands and they have their arguments and so on. You can provide some help. It's not complete here yet, but, at least we have something for a start. Actually, the tool is already quite rich compared to the vendor tool. So you can read out a bunch of information from the chips, but you can also read out memory directly. For example, you can write to memory. You can, use the dump command to, download a larger chunk of memory. Some 64 kilobyte blocks that you can get per step from the M-Logic devices. But, we coded something up that you could also use to, get more and more chunks out of it. So, you can just say, hey, give me, 4 megabytes from this and this address and so on. And, of course, you can do it in both directions. So that is what we provide the write command for. And of course, if you want to run something, there's the exec command where you could just jump to an address and execute code, or you can use the run command directly. Yeah, with some constraints, but yeah, definitely have a look at that tool if you're working with M-Logic SoCs. Now, we also created a command that is called Blinky, which for a handful of well-known boards that we already have, just does a little blinky demo on it. So essentially you can just say, like in this example here, AML_boot, blinky, and then the device name. This here being one from Libre Computer, the LC-S905D3-CC. It's a board that I actually got at a conference just recently, some month ago. And well, as you can see, we got the LEDs to shine. Okay, let's talk about some more boxes. So there is something very, very similar to those TV boxes, which is called set-top boxes, or STBs for short. It's essentially the same idea, but usually that would be something that is provided by your ISP, like your internet service provider. They would give you like some extra services, things they call like IPTV, for example, like internet protocol based television. So it's a bit like TV in a sense, but you have some sort of controlled environment with only a certain program they offer and so on. There is some on-demand streaming in there and stuff, but yeah, it's not a general purpose thing once again. Now the thing is, over time those devices may actually become obsolete because the provider may choose to cut down or completely shut down their services, or say, hey, this hardware is now deprecated. If you want to use our server still, you would need a newer box and so on. I'm very sure everybody here, knows a story like that one. So yeah, what do you do with that obsolete hardware? Of course, why not just reuse it for something else? Those are just perfectly fine boxes. They have their connectors like HDMI. They have USB connectors, networking, obviously, because it's, for video streaming. So essentially it's like a computer, like just like every other computer. Why not use it as one? So yeah, that is what Enrico did, and you know, he tried to get into the firmware first. It was unfortunately password protected, but yeah, he was a bit lucky with some findings. He tried a bunch of things. You can hear that in our podcast episode from just recently. Go definitely check that out. Anyway, at some point he was in, so he was now able to load his own code. Now, the thing was, there was a Linux kernel running on this, but we didn't have the sources. So we looked a bit, and I actually found a website at some point, and he said, "Hey, Daniel, you're a genius." Except that the download on that website was actually gone, so you know, you couldn't actually download anything. That was a bummer, but still, we knew the kernel version and so on, and well, what he then did was, well, just keeping the stock kernel, and he crafted a custom loader for ELF binary. So ELF being the executable and linkable format that is used in most Unix systems, or many Unix systems, and also in Linux. So yeah, here on this screenshot, you're seeing some console output from that loader, which, you know, just put something in memory and executed it. And well, in the end, you see a little hello message from the module that he was then building. So the thing was, you know, this box being perfectly fine, his idea was to actually reuse it as a little gaming console or something like that, right? So yeah, after some work, eventually, that was working, so he could just play video games on it. Like, you know, an SNES emulator and stuff like that. And yeah, if you want to listen to that podcast episode, definitely go check out that link here. All right, so now that we've talked about a lot of hacking stuff, let's actually talk about security, because that is something being very, very important nowadays, because we are exposing our devices to this giant network that we call the internet. And all of our devices are actually running firmware, and you know, that can lead us to certain issues. So, but let's talk about what kind of firmware we mean here, because it's a term that is being very, very broad, and you know, people have different ideas of what firmware might be. So, first, a little predicament here. There are some people who think of something that was called the BIOS. That is something from like the 80s or something, right? So, you know, that was essentially you know, where you could have some setup. You know, you could change some settings on your computer, and you know that you could have something very simple for the operating system to interact with. That is some sort of firmware, and that is also something that I look into quite a lot these days. Now, that is different from platform to platform. So if you're not on a PC, like, you know, a good old IBM PC or some compatible device, it might be that your firmware is actually quite different. And there is even people thinking of whole operating systems when they say firmware. Like the Android operating system, for example, that you have on your phone, some people consider that to be the firmware, even though it's actually a full-blown operating system already with, like, coming with applications even, right? So if you install a very simple stock Android operating system, you already have a bunch of apps in there, including a web browser, you know, calendar, and all of that stuff. Well, essentially, that is what you need on a phone anyway, in, you know, most cases. Of course, there are, like, feature phones, but, you know, we're talking about these, very fancy phones nowadays. Well, and of course there is, like, you know, different groups of people referring to that term. So there is, like, in marketing, for example, people might have a different idea of firmware. Colloquial speech, as I said, people have very, very different ideas. Different vendors, different products have their own labels and so on. Sometimes they include something in firmware, maybe more than actually necessary, you know, and that is where it becomes a bit interesting. You might also know about these services that are sometimes found in firmware, and that's what we're going to talk about in a bit. So yeah, but the very, very gist of firmware is usually just to bring up a computing platform. So really just do some initialization so that an operating system can run. In many cases, that just involves bringing up a memory controller and then, you know, loading the kernel into the memory that then becomes usable. So you would need to configure the memory controller, you would need to, you know, tell it, like, what parts to work with, give it timing parameters, and so on. you know, memory chips can be very, very different. There are now different generations of what we call DRAM. You know, maybe the terms DDR, like DDR1, 2, 3, 4. We're now at DDR5 even. And I'm not even sure if 6 is already in the makings. You know, things just develop over time. Anyway, those still need their parameters in a way. Sometimes they can be self-training and so on. But still, before you can actually run an operating system, you would need to bring those up. Well, and then after that, you can run your operating system or some bare metal application, some hypervisor and so on, which is then using all of that memory. So that is always something that the operating system cannot do by itself. Okay, now let's talk a bit about firmware interfaces and services. So you know that there are a bunch of devices being exposed to the internet. That can be, for example, cameras, like, you know, security cameras. That can be like toys of various kinds, you know, also adult toys, for example. But still, we know that when things are connected to the internet, we need to be very careful with them. Like your security camera, for example, if it's purpose is to monitor your house for, you know, burglars, then you want to be sure that you are the only one actually being able to look at that. Because if somebody could just see your camera from the internet because it's exposed to everyone in the public, now you're actually exposing like the inside of your house to the potential burglar, which is exactly the opposite of what you intended, right? So we need to be very careful that, you know, the equipment that we buy is not accidentally exposed to unknown people. Now, the thing is, these interfaces or services that we have are actually always considered as like part of a device or, you know, a platform that can be a cloud platform, for example, where a vendor says, hey, we provide the security gear. You can log into this and this space somewhere, you know. They would give you some URL, or they would provide you with an app, and then it would still be connected through some cloud or something. That is a very, very dangerous thing. But it can also be just your local machine. So in modern machines, you would find some interfaces that, you know, are actually talking to the operating system and vice versa. Now you need to be a bit careful with that because firmware is not usually often upgraded. So that is something we're trying to push for from the open source firmware and also the security communities, because we know that this is such a giant attack surface and, you know, you need to be very, very careful. And the most important thing is you need to be able to upgrade the firmware. Otherwise, you know, every finding that we have in the security community, every vulnerability that we discover and could technically mitigate would never actually get mitigated, right? So there is a company, for example, doing research in that space named Binarly. You will find the advisories that they have on their website. So yeah, I give you the URL here. And well, as I said, the firmware interfaces provide such a giant attack surface. They already have numerous findings here, more than 200 if you count those here. Many of which actually have a very high severity. So you see the scoring here. There is something called CVSS that is like a scoring system, essentially telling you, like, you know, how harmful a vulnerability can be. And then corresponding to that is the so-called CWE, that is the common weaknesses enumeration, which is coming from a larger organization called MITRE, MITRE.org is their website. Definitely have a look at that if you're interested in security and, you know, not very deep in that topic yet. So yeah, they essentially gave a number, like an identifier for, you know, each weakness that a device can have. And in fact, I just recently discovered they even have one, which is just for being able to upgrade firmware on your device. If you don't have that, you know, then that is a weakness of your device. Okay, so before we continue, I would like to do a small recap. Because I created a tool that would allow you to investigate your firmware. Now, this here, it's called Fiatka. It's mostly for firmware that you would find in your laptops nowadays, or your server platforms, or, you know, other kinds of mainboards, like desktop computers, for example, or, you know, these small thin clients that many people have in their offices, maybe. The current feature set is already quite rich, so we can analyze those firmware images. We can visualize how much of the firmware image is used. We call it flash usage, because usually it, you know, comes from a flash port on your main board. And you can explore the file systems therein, namely those being defined by UEFI, the Unified Extensible Firmware Interface, then the AMD PSP, that is their platform security processor, also has its own firmware. And then Coreboot. Coreboot also has a file system. And if somebody wanted to work on that, we would also be grateful if you know, we could support the Intel Management Engine. Definitely check out the website. It's called fietka.app. Well, now, if you analyze your firmware, you know, you might want to get an idea of, like, okay, what is the security state of my platform actually? So we're working on some extra features now. One is something I already talked about at previous conferences, a software bill of materials that, you know, would essentially, you know, give you an idea of what actually came into that firmware, where it came from, and so on. That is something that is currently being developed by the firmware industry, including the UEFI forum, but also the Coreboot project already has support for that. I'm not sure about the UBoot project, for example, but yeah, that is something that many people have been talking about. I think it's also covered in the EU Cyber Resilience Act, the CRA. Now, the other feature is there is a bunch of key material actually also in your firmware and also maybe fused into your chips. Intel, as a prominent example, has a feature that is called BootGuard, and that would prevent you from executing custom firmware, but also an attacker's firmware, hopefully. Unless, you know, sometimes it happens that keys that vendors have used might end up in the public by accident, or, you know, because somebody attacked their infrastructure and found those and extracted those keys and so on. So yeah, we started drafting a feature while we were talking about secure boot. So the idea of secure boot is that you secure your boot process from the start on. And BootGuard would be the initial feature on Intel platforms providing that. Everything coming later on is worth nothing if your BootGuard is compromised. So what we're doing here is we want to give you an alert if we find some already known to be exposed or outdated BootGuard keys. So, you know, keys expire either by, you know, ending up in the public. But we're talking about the private key that is used for signing here, right? Or people, you know, people might actually have some old keys which like reach their end of life. So that depends a bit. It's not necessarily applicable here, I'm not too sure. But there is definitely, you know, different key infrastructures, and, you know, some might have expiry dates, for example. So yeah, if you have a key somewhere that is already expired, you know, that might keep you from booting a machine, for example, depending on the specific scenario. Okay, and the last point we want to cover here today is something that came out just very recently. Also a finding by Binarly. They published something, you might have seen it in the news, it was actually quite big. They called it Logo Fail. And well, what Logo Fail is about is many vendors allow you to have your own custom splash screen when you turn on your computer. And, you know, then, you know, usually you would see something like Dell or Lenovo and so on, right? But, you know, they provide you with tools to have your own custom screen. That might be, you know, funny for some companies, for example, which would like to apply some branding, or, you know, some end users would actually, you know, also like to have their own images. Like, I would actually like to do that. It's something that made me look into the Coreboot project back in the days, because I found the idea very appealing and cool that I could have my own splash screen, right? So yeah, it's very good when the vendor has a tool for that and so on. But of course, there can be problems with that, because you need to be very, very careful when processing user input. So yeah, if you're not careful, then this might happen. This here is from an actual device we looked into. It's a Lenovo ThinkPad X270. And we tried to reproduce the Logo Fail findings. And guess what? We could actually reproduce a bunch of the issues. So the parsers that are being used to parse images here, they're actually not too robust and sophisticated. So for example, they might, as in this case here, they might read out of their bounds. So usually, you know, when you parse binary data, you would check first, like, how much data am I going to process? Like, you know, what kind of format do I have here? And now depending on the format, you might need to, you know, read and copy data around, or, you know, walk through certain structures, like it can be tables, for example. And actually, I just saw another video today from, I forget his name. I think it was Live Overflow who found it. Yeah, and he was talking about a similar thing in, you know, very many systems and web browsers, which was about the WebP image parser. Yeah, definitely also check that out. This here now was a bitmap parser. So if you know bitmaps, then you know there is a header in the beginning, which tells you the image dimensions. And then after that, you know, comes some more information, like, you know, the bits per pixel that we have. And then just comes a lot of data, which essentially describes the pixels. And then, you know, depending on that previous data, you would need to, like, allocate a buffer of a certain size. And then you can step by step copy into that buffer. But, you know, what happened here was actually lied about those image dimensions. I said the image was much larger than what I actually provided. So this one here was 120 by 120 pixels. That was the original image. But I said, hey, it's like, I don't know, some thousand pixels. And then the parser just kept reading and reading and reading beyond the actual image data that I provided. And now what you see here reflected by, you know, those fancy colors, and then you see, you know, these black gaps in between and so on, that is actually the memory that you see visualized here. So if you know how to interpret this stuff, then you can get an idea of what the memory structure is like. And, you know, in the worst case, you would be able to even execute your own code through such a vulnerability. Now, that is something we have not yet reproduced, but we're definitely looking into that. And, you know, we might actually find something very soon. So, yeah, what Binary did was they were fuzzing, you know, just all the image parsers from all the vendors, essentially, and found all of them to be vulnerable. So now the thing is, you know, when you find such a thing, you still need to have some tools to work with that, right? So the idea is the following here. Now, if we were able to put something somewhere in memory that was actually not intended like that, or, you know, we could read or write across the boundaries that should be there, you know, we would like to check on that later on. And the thing is, because that is happening now in firmware, and then, you know, usually our operating system would be loaded, now we need a tool to scan the memory and see what happened there. So I started working on a little tool to scan your DRAM. Well, I just called it Find Me for the time being, you know, to keep it very simple. And the Find Me tool just gets a few parameters. You give it a file to search. In this scenario here, we're using the devmem device from the Linux kernel, which exposes all the memory to you. And, you know, if you provide the right settings to the Linux kernel, you can really just read all the memory. Usually that would be protected, so you couldn't just read arbitrarily everything, like the kernel's memory, for example. And also the firmware's memory should not be readable. But yeah, of course, we wanted to, you know, check on something, so I turned off those options in my custom kernel here. Then we can provide a size for, you know, a step size to scan. So if you think of your memory, let's say this machine, for example, has 8 gigabytes of memory, right? And if you want to scan all of that, like at every byte offset that you can imagine, that takes a very, very long time. So what we do instead is we just jump a specific number of bytes. And in this case here, we're using 8 bytes per step. Now we can provide an offset. You know, in this case here, I provided something which is, you know, actually quite far in memory already. And then we can also give it a limit, so, you know, that it only scans as much and then returns all the information. And yeah, you can already see it's printing out something here. So we already filled quite a bit to, you know, figure all of this out. I actually put a bunch of axes in the custom image that I provided, you know, the thing that you saw being very, very colorful earlier. And, you know, now I could just search for the axes here in the memory. And, well, I also put a little message in the file, so that was something I could definitely recognize, right? So the axes could be false positives, but yeah, I wanted to have a good indicator. And lo and behold, we actually found that message again. We wrote something like, ChaosBot says hello, UEFI is awesome, you know, just for the fun of it. And you might even see my nickname here in the memory dump. Now, this already being quite interesting, we would actually like to reproduce or reconstruct the memory as the firmware saw it earlier. So I figured that there are some data structures defined in a project called EDK2, that is the reference project for UEFI platform firmware. And if you look at that, there are, like, you know, some headers. You don't see them in this screenshot here, but yeah, they are definitely in that memory. So we want to write tools for that as well, and then publish them. Well, and we actually also talked about that in one of our petty foos. So that was about parsing binary data. I found some examples where I wanted to simply showcase, like, okay, this is what data can look like. We looked at some image formats, for example, but also some binary data that we find in firmware. So yeah, here is the link to the slide that you can look the slides that you can look into. And what we essentially do is we just define our data structures that we're looking for in our favorite language, Rust in this instance, and then we would need to construct objects from, you know, the buffers that we read. So you would read some file or some slides from memory or something, and then you would need to construct something from it. And then you have, like, very nicely readable data structures. In the Rust language itself, for example, in the standard and core libraries, there is already a very, very rich tool for dumping your binary data than in, you know, your representation. So if you define your structures and so on in Rust, you can just say variable name colon question mark, and then, you know, it would print out a very, very nice data structure for you. So yeah, if you know interpreter language, that is something you might be used to. In the C language, that is usually not the case. You would either need some library for that, you know, or make your own custom formatter for it. And well, that's actually the very same thing we're doing in the Fiatka project, you know, and then we just visualize the data in a bit of a different way. We don't just want to print it out, but we want to have a nice look at that. If you've worked with Fiatka before, you might already know what I'm talking about. Otherwise, definitely go check out the tool. And of course, if we come up with something nice here for the firmware, data structures, we might also be able to visualize that in a very, very nice way. For example, I can imagine that, you know, because we're talking about memory, for example, we might actually draw a tree of that memory, like in memory management, there is something that is called page tables. That is a concept where, you know, you would divide your memory into these different pages, and then you would have tables that are, you know, looking at the different pages. You know, you have, like, something like pointers and so on. And the thing is, if you want to interpret the data, it helps you to get some visualization first so that you can see if it looks right. So, of course, you can just, you know, print it out, like, you know, just the like the numbers, for example, in hex representation and so on. But yeah, maybe we can also do something a bit nicer. And that might even help you with developing operating systems, because it's essentially the same thing that you're doing there when managing memory. Well, and with that, I would like to thank you a lot. I would highly welcome if you wanted to follow me. Just go ahead, you will find me on GitHub at OrangeCMS, you would find me on Twitter or whatever they call it today, X. I have done a bunch of live streams that I would then do on Twitch usually. They're gone after a week, but I put them up again on YouTube, and on Twitch and YouTube you find me as SciRevolt. And the slides we just looked at here, you can find them at metaspora.org, just follow that link here. And eventually, I would like to invite you also to have a look at our hackerspace. So come visit us at chaospod.de. That is our website. And if you know you're in a different area, we also have channels in Matrix for remote communication, so you can chat with us. Or maybe if you would like to just, you know, get to know us a bit, you know, and you're a bit shy or something, just welcome to the channel and have a look. And now with that, thank you very, very much. And I'm happy to answer your questions if you have any.
Hello and welcome to the Q&A for Bringing the Hack Back into the Chaos. I've got Daniel Maslowski here with me right now to answer some of your questions. First of all, do you have any other projects that you would like to mention?
Yes. So, yeah, I already presented a bunch. But of course, we do a bit more. One person in our hackerspace, his nickname is MoffAX. He at some point brought one of these fiber to network thingies that you know I'm a networking person. you would put them in switches and stuff like that. He wanted to also customize the firmware and that a bit. Actually, just change a serial number for a friend of his. We found a tool for that on GitHub. It is called UF Instant Mod, that is mostly a write-up and stuff. And then we also found some other tool. And the thing was, that tool wasn't really working with that version that he had, or with that hardware revision or whatever, because it was expecting some. So the tool was expecting some things, but you know that device was actually a bit different. So we just did that by hand, and you know we looked at how that thing works. Extracted the firmware, we took it apart a bit, and essentially there was just a file system that we know it's called JFFS2. And so what we then contributed back was all of our findings there. So if you look at that repository nowadays, you will find that in there. Now, we also did a few things with OpenWRT. So you know that many people put that on their home routers, or you know, it's also used by the Fifunk project. And you can actually find also a good handful of gadgets which are running some shape or form of OpenWRT, or maybe something entirely custom or semi-custom. Then you would like to have some upstream OpenWRT on it. I have a portable router, which is essentially a giant battery pack and then some very small PCB at the top, and that is by default, just running a very, very old kernel. It's probably vulnerable in like 100 places and stuff. So I thought, okay, let's just put OpenWRT onto it. It is equipped with a very well-known chip that is the MediaTek MT something. I'm not sure about the exact number now. And I contributed that back to the wiki. So yeah, it's in the work in progress section, but you can already find it there. The manufacturer name is Wudumi, Wudoumi. If you search for that in the wiki, you will find it.
How are you proceeding with LogoFail?
Yeah, so that is a very good question. So in the live sessions that I did, and also what I just said here in the presentation, I only came to that point where, you know, we could just poke around a bit, essentially. We now have a USB drive that we can just use to put custom images on Lenovo devices. So essentially everybody can use that. I even talked about that in one of the live sessions. I didn't really mention it, I think. We now started developing this tool that would scan through the memory that is used by EFI. Well, it would actually scan the entire memory, and then you would use it to find the EFI memory. And I just brought it to a point where we also understand the EFI memory structures to some degree. So you will find that on GitHub now at the Platform System Interface project. And it's just called EMS for EFI Memory Scanner. And we're going to extend the tool a bit more. I'm not too sure where it will take us so far. That is definitely one part. And the other part is, so we still don't really have a good environment for developing an exploit. So one idea is to just dump the binaries from the foamer that are parsing the image. I already started looking at that in Ghidra, but we would also like to just throw that into an emulation environment so that we can try out a bunch of things in the emulation environment. And then we can control that environment much better than on the actual laptop. And then when we have found something, well, we're essentially looking for a buffer overflow here, then we would be able to create a full proof of concept thing that we could also then share on GitHub for like research and teaching and so on.
That sounds awesome. So you're just basically building up on that and that whole analysis side to try and figure out how to develop it and to allow other people to build up on it.
Yeah. So essentially, that is if you come from a software engineering standpoint, we're using the same methods that you would also use for developing software. Like when you test software, you do the very same thing, right? So you set up your environment for testing, then you make small changes, and then you check on the result afterwards and see if that is actually what you wanted. So yeah, we want to have that same kind of setup where we can get to conclusions very quickly without being in the dark, like, okay, did we actually trigger this here, or did this and that happen? Because it can get very, very complicated easily. Yeah,
and I guess the fact that you're dealing with an EFI environment means that in the worst case, you have to deal with a hardware machine having to completely reset before you can test your hypothesis, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So that is a ton easier in a virtual environment, yep.
I think that's it for today. Thank you very much for your talk, shining some light on what's happening and bringing the hack back into the chaos. Thank you for your talk.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for having me. Enjoy the rest.